In our gospel lesson, Jesus offers us a very interesting question, asking, is it lawful to do good or to do harm on the Sabbath, to save life or to kill? And if we leap ahead into the 21st century, we might discover that we ourselves are asking the very same question, just in a little different way. What is the point of practicing a religion? Why gather in a sacred space week after week? Why pray? Why give of ourselves? Why engage in any religious practice at all? Is it really worth the effort? A priest and a preacher were standing on the side of the road with a sign. It said, "The end is near. Turn around before it's too late." A man saw it in a convertible and he slowed down long enough to yell at them, "You religious fanatics, you're just a bunch of weirdos and idiots." It wasn't long before you heard screeching tires and the sound of a terrible car crash. The priest looked at the preacher and said, "Do you think it would have been better if our sign had read, 'Warning, bridge out ahead'?" This summer, we will be seeking a better way to live out our faith with an intentional strategy to practice gratitude. Now, admittedly, you can cultivate a more grateful spirit and reap the benefits of it in your life without necessarily following a religious tradition. Being grateful is a very practical skill available for anyone to use. But there's so much more to our lives, more than just a little tweak here or a little tweak there to get everything all straightened out. Three books are shaping this series of gratitude for me. One, of course, the Bible. We'll be looking at the stories of Jesus in the Gospel of Mark and a couple of passages in Ephesians. Then another book, a New York Times bestseller from Janice Kaplan called The Gratitude Diaries. You'll see a quote from that book in your worship bulletin. And finally, a book from Episcopal priest and theologian Diana Butler Bass called Grateful, The Transformative Power of Giving Thanks. And let's first address what Diana Butler Bass calls the gratitude gap. The gratitude gap. The distance between our awareness of the vital importance and the lasting impact that gratitude might play into our lives and our utter failure to adequately appropriate it into our daily experiences. A study from the John Templeton Foundation found 94% of Americans, you can't get that many Americans to agree on anything, 94% believe that people who are grateful are also more fulfilled and lead richer lives. But get this. Less than half of those surveyed said that they expressed any gratitude at all on any regular basis. 94%. This is a good thing. We all ought to be able to do it. Less than half that actually do so. A gratitude gap. The gap. It's real. Indeed, the bridge is out. Janice Kaplan describes gratitude like a magical happiness rock that's sitting out on a field. We can see it. We can see it. It's just right over there. It's visible, accessible, ready for us to take. All we have to do is walk over and pick it up and carry it with us. But most of us won't even bother. Maybe it's too easy. Maybe picking up the gratitude rock, as magical it is to give you happiness, makes you look vulnerable or appearing naive. Maybe you've got better things to do. Maybe there's just too many other things that get in the way. But the dilemma is real. And perhaps the gratitude gap is even more severe with a weird dynamic, particularly for us in this country. Taking into account we who lead such blessed lives, especially in comparison to the many in the world and other parts who have far, far less of the wealth and privilege and opportunity we enjoy, an advantage that all of us share that's as close as the end of every one of our fingertips as we scan and click and purchase and wait no more than 3 days usually for whatever that wonderful world goodie comes delivered to the stoop of our very doorsteps. These who are also the very same ones with more limited experiences and moments of feeling profound gratitude. Something doesn't add up, does it? Maybe Jesus can help us. He teaches that if we follow the path of faith, not only in order to do good, but to be good in our doing of it, we are reaching toward a goodness that will save lives, ours, and our neighbors, to do no harm, to protect all from further damage, to fend off destruction, and if possible, by the work of the Holy Spirit, to correct life's divisions and blunders. The healing directive guides the way Jesus understood and interpreted his own tradition, and the way it should guide us too. Laws are important, but they were not meant to always be absolute, to deal with every single case, to be followed with such precise devotion that it was impossible then to see God at work or to celebrate God's intervening goodness. Certainly for Jesus, laws were not given as a test to see if you would be obedient or to prove your worth. Instead, laws and the whole of the religious enterprise are given as a means for something far more important, namely human reconciliation and fulfillment and enjoyment in relation to God's unconditional love and grace. We follow the laws, even those we don't find easily understood or don't comprehend completely or difficult to practice, because of their potential to a greater amount of life satisfaction. But laws are powerful and can be used wrongly and abusively. They can get in the way as yet another shackle upon the oppressed, those who are suffering. It can be used by the powerful to take advantage and exploit the weak. So when following laws, the faithful are pushed too concretely and dangerously from feelings of empathy or compassion, and yes, deep appreciation and gratitude. As long as I'm doing what I'm supposed to do, I could care about everybody else. And when religion becomes that kind of oppression, then it becomes sour and corrupt. Perhaps you've thought this many times. I've thought it thousands of times, probably in the past month. And it just keeps coming back and back and back to me. This question, what our age is rejecting, is not a healthy and helpful, positive representation of Christian faith. No. What they're rejecting is a perverse and misguided representation of it. Who wants to hang out with ingrates and bigots prigs and know-it-alls, pessimists and worrywarts. I guess we all could use, myself included, first candidate here, a fresh and abundant installment of gratitude, appreciative of my life and all its many blessings and all their myriads of forms. So how do you get there? How can we work together over the summer to cultivate a summer of gratitude? We'll be offering many suggestions throughout the course of this series. But for now, let me point to this strategy called reframing, to take the same experience and look at it from a totally different perspective. Dr. Robert Edmonds of the University of California, Davis, describes it this way: grateful people reframe whatever happens to them. They don't focus on what they're lacking. They make sure they see the good in what they have. Now, certainly, this is one of those things we might say, well, that's a lot easier said than done. But it will take some effort, some work, a purposeful rewriting of our thoughts and behaviors, to be willing to change, to adjust our perspectives, to start something new. Each week throughout the course of this summer, we will be offering what we are referring to as next steps, a way for you to have a practical plan of action after you hear this sermon or participate in the morning service on gratitude that you might be able to incorporate into your life this week. Nothing too earth-shattering. But for this week, we are encouraging you to keep a gratitude journal. In fact, we've purchased a few of these small notebooks with a little bit of room you could place in your pocket. They're available on the table as you leave. Or if you want something a little fancier, that's okay too. I know some people like fancy or gratitude journals or diaries. And as you are grateful, maybe at the end of the day, maybe every other couple of days, maybe just once a week, you would just simply write down that thing that you are grateful for, or that experience, or that awareness, or that insight, or that observation. Just taking a little catalog of good things that happen in your life, keeping a record, accumulating a list. Like planting a garden and tending it and watering it and pulling out the weeds and watching it grow and then all of a sudden being surprised. And there's that great big summer squash or that big, ripe, juicy tomato right there for you to take. Allow your list to grow and start focusing on these wonderful gifts in your life, because we can't help ourselves. Perhaps socialized by our parents, but just a part of the culture in which we live, we focus on the negative all the time. All the time. It overwhelms us. Psychologist Paul Rozin has pointed out that a cockroach can completely spoil a bowl of cherries, but one cherry has nothing of power to improve upon the appeal of a bowl of cockroaches. Some psychologists have looked into this question. They say it takes four positive statements, maybe even as many as five positive statements, to outweigh one negative statement. That when we hear something critical, when we hear something that weighs upon us, when we hear something that is negative, well, we have to put on a full court press to not allow that to get the best of us. And we are experiencing wave after wave after wave after wave of criticism and negativity and pessimism and despair. the good stuff. It's not just going to come up and grab you. You have to go hunting for it. But it's there. You just need to develop the skill to find it and appreciate it. Wouldn't you agree, as you've heard the gospel stories over and over again, as you've listened to countless sermons, as you've opened your Bible and read about the way of Jesus, that this is his call of discipleship that he asks us to follow? I mean, there he is, surrounded by a bunch of naysayers and legalists, incapable of noticing and celebrating the joy of a man who had been healed of a withered hand. They could care less. Religion for them was a duty and a fidelity, not mercy and kindness. As serious as they presented themselves as being about the things of God, they could not enter into the generous grace of God. I like the way Canadian theologian Gordon Fee has described the Holy Trinity. He speaks of the giver, the gift, and the giving. The giver, the gift, and the giving. The dynamic and mutually fulfilling relationship that creates and sustains and redeems all that is. Gratitude is the door. The frame we can walk through to join our lives with the love feast of giving that is eternally present in God's own self. In our gospel, Jesus healed a man with a withered hand. But I think if we let him, we might find that Jesus is also pretty good with a withered heart. I'm praying this summer we will all be a little bit kinder, a little bit more merciful, and certainly a whole lot more grateful.